On this 23rd day of May 2011 in San Diego, we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 2 entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized, and we are on text 229. Ashcharyavat pashyati kaschadenam. Ashcharyavat vadati tathaya vachanyah. Ashcharyavat chayanam anyak shrinoti. Shudvapyenam vedana chayava kashchit. Some look on the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, and some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. Purport. Since Gita Upanishad is largely based on the principles of the Upanishads, it is not surprising to also find this passage in the Katha Upanishad 1.2.7. Shavanayapi bahubi yo nalabhyaha shinvanto pi bahavo yam navidyuhu ashtaryo vakta kusalo sya labdha ashtaryo sya gyata kusalanu shishtaha. The fact that the atomic soul is within the body of a gigantic animal, in the body of a gigantic banyan tree, and also in the microbic germs, millions and billions of which occupy only an inch of space, is certainly very amazing. Men with a poor fund of knowledge and men who are not austere cannot understand the wonders of the individual atomic spark of spirit, even though it is explained by the greatest authority of knowledge who imparted lessons even to Brahma, the first living being in the universe. Owing to a gross material conception of things, most men in this age cannot imagine how such a small particle can become both so great and so small. So men look at the soul proper as wonderful, either by constitution or by description. Illusioned by the material energy, people are so engrossed in subject matters for sense gratification that they have very little time to understand the question of self-understanding, even though it is a fact that without this self-understanding, all activities result in ultimate defeat in the struggle for existence. Perhaps they have no idea that one must think of the soul and thus make a solution to the material miseries. Some people who are inclined to hear about the soul may be attending lectures in good association, but sometimes, owing to ignorance, they are misguided by acceptance of the supersoul and the atomic soul as one without distinction of magnitude. It is very difficult to find a man who perfectly understands the position of the supersoul, the atomic soul, their respective functions and relationships, and all other major and minor details. And it is still more difficult to find a man who has actually derived full benefit from knowledge of the soul, and who is able to describe the position of the soul in different aspects. But if, somehow or other, one is able to understand the subject matter of the soul, then one's life is successful. The easiest process for understanding the subject matter of self, however, is to accept the statements of the Bhagavad Gita spoken by the greatest authority, Lord Krishna, without being deviated by other theories. But it also requires a great deal of penance and sacrifice, either in this life or in the previous ones, before one is able to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna can, however, be known as such by the causeless mercy of the pure devotee and by no other way. Om Jnana Timarandasya Jnanandana Shalakya Chakshu Unmiratam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and to all members of Sri Parampara. So the material energy is such that it completely bewilders the living entity. As soon as we identify with this gross body that we're in, or the subtle mind, then our ability to understand the soul recedes into the background. And it can be like that for millions of births. Only in the human form of life can we even begin to ask these questions, can we begin to understand the soul. And then only if one comes in contact with someone like Srila Prabhupada through his books or some other realized soul who can lead us in a path that will kind of revolutionize our understanding of who we are. Because inevitably, without such guidance, one must identify with the gross and subtle body. Meaning that we think that we are a certain age, we are a certain gender, we speak a certain language, we have this relationship, that relationship. And all of that together defines who we think we are. In other words, our sense of self or ego. But the first lesson of the Bhagavad Gita, as we're learning here, this is one more verse and we'll be finished with Krishna's 20-verse lesson on the soul in the second chapter here. This 20 verses beginning 2:11, where he's talking about the self, the Atma. And this is the foundational concept before we can move forward in our enterprise or in our quest for enlightenment. So this is essential. And here Krishna, he's saying, echoing the Upanishads, that it's very difficult. It's amazing. It's inconceivable. That word has been used to describe the soul. Achintoyam, avyaktoyam. Something that's invisible, that you can't weigh, that you can't smell, that you can't taste or see. In other words, it's not accessible to one of the senses. That's pretty amazing. You know, because within our experience, everything is perceivable in that way. And material science, right, which people place so much faith in, is based on that kind of information, that kind of investigation. If we want to, like, there's so many amazing things about today's, say, knowledge base, what people take as part of what's known to science and what we take for granted. If you go back even like 30 years and you try to describe even this little thing that I'm working on right here, this little iPod, what to speak about the iPhone, you know, with all of the apps and all of the things you can do with computers and being hooked up and connected, and they would say that doesn't sound believable. So science and technology, through the scientific method of investigation and building on what's gone before, right? There's always an increase in knowledge. When they build cars, they don't have to start from scratch. There's so much that they know, right? There's an art and science to building cars. And it seems like that is the kind of investigation that can give us the truth about our environment, about the world. But when you introduce something that is not amenable to that kind of investigation, such as the soul or consciousness, then people scratch their heads. Is there really such a thing? You know. But I think that when you kind of stop, when you come into contact with an environment like this, you know, Bhagavad Gita or the Krishna conscious movement, then there are ways of investigating that, or at least opening the question, so that the plausibility of the existence of the soul rises up and it makes sense. So the first thing is to stop one's the mind, which is always going on to the next thing, and just think a minute about what we are. And when you think a little bit about it, you can see that we're actually the observer of all of these experiences that we're having. Right, both subtle and gross. A gross experience is like a sensation of heat or cold. Everyone has experience of that from childhood. Sometimes it's too cold, you got to put some clothes on, heat up the house. It's too hot, turn on the air conditioning, take a swim, right, or go to the ocean, right? So we immediately have this understanding of a sensation like heat or cold, like in the body. So, but if you think about it a minute, We are aware of that. In other words, we are the being who's aware of that sensation. Right? We're not the sensation. We are aware of the sensation. Now, we may identify with it. I'm cold. I'm hot. Because we're identifying with this body. But when you really think about it, you're aware of that. And you can understand sometimes if you have a... I was just talking to somebody who had an operation. You know, it would have been very painful, but it wasn't. Because their consciousness was separated from the body, meaning that they were put under, you know, anesthesia, right? You're still in there, right? You wake up eventually, you had the operation, it may be kind of sore, but you didn't have the kind of pain you would have had if you didn't have anesthesia. So what happened there? What happened there? By the intervention of medicine, you know, some kind of drug or whatever they use for anesthesia, you were put to sleep. You, the soul, the conscious being, was no longer aware of what was going on in your body. Right? So it happened. The operation took place. Right? And you're still the same person. You're still there. But you're not aware of it. So therefore, you're not the body. The body went through so many changes, some little trauma there. You know, now it's recovering. And you, by the miracles of modern science, missed the... You know, all the suffering and pain that would have taken place. Right? So this is proof that you as the experiencer don't necessarily have to be connected to the body. There's so many things that are going on with your body that you're not aware of, right? Thank God. You know, so many things are happening automatically. When they go wrong, you become aware when there's some pain or suffering, right? So we are experiencing so many things. And on the subtle level... You know, we all experience emotions. It may not be a bodily thing. It may have a bodily component. You know, it may show you're embarrassed and you turn red, you know, or you're in ecstasy, or you're happy and you smile, you know, or you're sad and you cry. But that's not the emotion. That's the result of the emotion, right? So that's an internal experience you're having, a mental experience. And you're aware of that. You yourself are aware of that emotion. And they have, medications. If you're always sad and melancholy, depressed, they have something that could make you happier, right? It's a huge number of people are taking that in America today. Antidepressants. You know? We don't need that. We just chant Hare Krishna. But the point is that, you know, that can be changed. But it's still you that's being aware of it. So the whole idea in these few verses here is to try to understand... that you, the person, are not either the gross body or the subtle mind, but rather you're just the knower. As Krishna says in the 13th chapter, the chetra gya. Chetram is a word that means field. So this is our field. We have the physical field, we all know that, in which we experience so many things. You also have the internal field, the mind. That's also part of the field of the body, the subtle body we call it. And that's where you live. Right? So many things are happening. And you also have actions that you perform on the basis of your ideas and sensations. Very complicated. We have the hands, right? The hands are part of the field, essential to doing work, right? So all of that is the field for the knower. But all the knower, the soul, the atma, the self, is just aware of all of these things going on. And since we're persons, we have desires based on what's come in, on ideas that we have, dreams, sensations that take place. It's a constant flow of desires, and on the other side, things that we don't desire, we're trying to avoid. This is actually what's happening in our life. If you're not aware of that, if you don't stop to think and go along these lines and hear from these things, that just doesn't occur. You're simply going from sensation to sensation, idea, idea, dream to dream, right? And this is how you live your life. And then you have a whole other life when you sleep, the actual dream world, when you kind of put things together, aspirations, fears that come in. You probably forget the dream in the morning and you're off to your other life. Isn't this how we live day by day? So, but if you don't think about it, you don't even think that there's a knower of these things. You just think that you are those things. Who am I? I'm the relationships, I'm the body, I'm this, and oh, now I'm getting old, you know, oh, I'm sick, you know. Oh my God, I've just, you know, broken my arm, you know. And you identify with that, right? And you're not, so the Vedic culture tries to awaken us to this reality that this whole life of being absorbed in the sensations of the body, identifying with the body, this is not our real life. This is a great restriction on the real life of the spirit or the soul. That's something we have to hear from a higher authority. Because you won't find it in the universities. You won't find it on the internet. Well, you find some of it on the internet now. But generally speaking, this is a mystery. It is a great mystery. That's why Krishna calls this guyam. You know, this is a confidential knowledge that can only come from souls who have, you know, the basic quieted the mind. In other words, yogis, that's the whole point. You quiet the mind. So the mind is not giving you all this static and confused and quiet, and then you start perceiving the real self. And the ultimate self that you perceive is a person with a spiritual body, spiritual form, spiritual activities. So this first lesson is very key because it changes the whole game. Otherwise, we're simply absorbed in the ordinary course of events in trying to do things that are pleasing to the bodies that we have. Certainly the gross body and the subtle body. For the subtle body, we want esteem, we want prestige, adoration, you know. For the gross body, so many physical comforts, things that please the senses. That's all we're concerned with on an immediate or a long-range basis. That's it. But then as soon as you get to the concept that that's not my real self and that all of that's going to disappear at a certain point, that's not a mystery. The whole idea of living in the moment or living for the next, you know, week or month or 10 years or 20 or 30 years ignores that elephant in the room, death. Whatever we're trying to establish in this world is taken away by death. Krishna says, I, as death, take it all away. Mrityu sarva hatascha. So if we want to really plan for our ultimate welfare, we have to take that into consideration. And if you take that fact into consideration, then all of the enterprise to try to make the body comfortable or wealthy in this lifetime, to try to build up some kind of something in this world, it's simply a sandcastle. If a child goes and builds a sandcastle, the mother may let him do it for a few hours, and the kid is totally into it, for an hour or two, and then it's kind of time to go home, But mommy, I just built a sandcastle. Just let this, the ocean's going to come in and destroy it. That's exactly what we're trying to build here. From the biggest industrialist down to the, little street sweeper, we're all in this illusion that somehow we can establish something permanent in this world. So where is their permanence? This is where we have to go. We have to go to the source of knowledge that's not bounded by these limitations of the body and the mind and the senses. And that's books like the Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna is speaking to us. Now, the understanding here, in terms of the Bhagavad Gita itself, that Krishna is the source of everything. He is what we call the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he knows exactly what's happening and the principles behind how everything works. And he knows what's best for us. And he's giving us advice here about how to act in a certain way for our ultimate benefit. Now, sometimes, often actually, it doesn't really compute according to our material conception of what's good. And that's why Arjuna has got a material conception. And it sounds pretty good. Why shouldn't we want to see our relatives and our friends alive? I don't want to be responsible for killing my revered grandfather Bhishma or my revered teacher Drona. What to speak of all these others who I have this relationship with? They're on the other side of the battle. This is taking place on a battlefield, this conversation. And so Arjuna has this calculation. I don't want to do it. What do I need this kingdom for? On the material side, being a soft-hearted, considerate person, he's saying, forget about the kingdom. I just don't want to be involved in this whole war, killing the people who I love. It seems like a good argument. And he bolstered it with a socio-political argument from the Vedas that if I kill all these men, the women will be abandoned, and then the children won't be raised properly, and it'll create havoc in society. So that's a further reason, besides his own personal reason. You see? So it seems to be a pretty good argument. I remember during the Vietnam War years, I don't know if I was so much a pacifist, but I was definitely a conscientious objector, draft resistor. I wasn't going to fight in this war. I saw it as absolutely wrong, what the Americans were doing. Bombing these poor people, you know, their home and so many things. And I said, no way, you know. And so, in one sense, I was identifying with Arjun. Now, it's, you know, the analogy totally breaks down because it was a bad war. It was, you know, it's not Krishna's desire that we were in Vietnam. But the whole idea of basing my activities on what I felt was an unnecessary and unjust killing of people, that I could identify with Arjun here. The only problem is that this war is actually what we call a just war. This war is absolutely justified because, first of all, they try to avoid it as much as possible. And the motive for fighting this war is not some material gain or aggrandizement. It's for reinstating Dharma and good in the world as a ruling force. Can you imagine if we had a saint actually running this country? You know, and all the Congress and the Senate was made up of pure devotees. How good this country would be? There'd be a lot of changes to make. But that's what Krishna's doing here. He's reinstituting Dharma at the top, you know, in the person of Yudhishthira as the ruling emperor of the world. So what a wonderful thing it would be. Just like Ram Raj, you know, when Ram was ruling the earth, people were ecstatic, they were happy. Oh, we're ruled by the Lord himself. And he has no motive for ruling other than our own welfare. You know, this verse where we're learning, swastastu viswasa kalak pasiditam. There's a prayer by Prahlad where he prays, oh, may everybody practice Krishna consciousness and have their mind absorbed in the transcendence of Hokshaja, so that they will think of each other's welfare. Just imagine if everybody in this country was thinking of each other's welfare rather than just me and my family, my tribe, you know. This is why it's Kali Yuga. Kali is the age of quarrel, dissension. So yes, the soul is amazing, and without practicing the process of yoga, without hearing and accepting this knowledge, then it doesn't compute. And the scientists, you know, will argue. I mean, they make a joke out of it. You know, when you give something a pejorative name, then you can easily dismiss it. Yeah, the ghost in the machine. You ever hear that? It's not so common now, but there's no ghost in the machine. This is the machine. They admit the body is the machine, a very complicated machine, but that's all it is. They don't. When Krishna says in the 18th chapter, Ishurak Sabhabhutanam, what is it? Sabhabhutanam Yantra. Vindeshya Dunatishati, Brahmiyan Sabhabhutani Yantra Rudani Maya. So the Yantra Rudani means mounted on a yantra. Yantra is the Sanskrit for machine. And this machine is made of the material energy. But he says the Ishvara is there. He's talking about this supreme soul. There's two souls. Krishna is also in our heart in the form of the super soul. So, and there's also the individual soul. So the individual soul is in the body. And there's also the super soul who's overseeing everything in everyone's body. But the point is, it's a combination. It's a combination. Everything we see is a combination of spirit and matter. It's not just matter. The reductionist scientists are trying to convince you that it's just matter. And ultimately, you see the result of that, and we're seeing it today, is that they're sucking out personality and meaning from everything. If I'm just a machine, and my consciousness is just a result of, you know, a chemical activity in the brain, then how am I different than a computer? I'm not. And they say, yes, very soon. The geniuses in MIT are saying, yes, we're right on the verge of artificial intelligence. We're going to build a computer and a robot that has exactly the same thing as you. Emotions, caring, consciousness, memory, everything. This is what they're claiming. But they can't. They can't. They can't do it. Because, huh? Krishna couldn't do that. But the thing is, it's a combination. The soul is there. You know, there's no soul in the computer, in the robot. It can only do what's been programmed. Yeah. You know, actually, I was thinking about this recently, that The effort to build, artificial intelligence, as well as the way in which they create these games now, you know, these video games, just so realistic and get so absorbed and identify with it. This is a proof, not a conclusive proof, but an indication proof that there is a God. Because how does intelligent design, right? There's an intelligent designer. Well, didn't someone design the games? One or more people use their intelligence to figure that out? So it would be so realistic, so realistic, so realistic. Well, look how realistic this is.
Yeah, but the best thing about it, we believe them only if the one game will spawn another game and create its own game. But
this is a different point. The idea is that this world, which is the best video game, right? Very realistic, isn't it? It's just like the video game, which are more and more realistic. But isn't there an intelligent designer behind that?
Yeah.
Of course. But it doesn't dawn on them that that's an indication that there's also an intelligent designer of this game. And this is actually no more than a game. I this wonderful lecture, Prabhupada gave this analogy, it's great. He talks about the Kumbh Mela. You know what the Kumbh Mela is? Most people, somebody know. The Kumbh Mela is a huge gathering of people in India. Every 12 years they have a Mahakumbh Mela. Is I think every 12 years, in Prayag. Prayag is the confluence of the Ganges and the Yamuna River. So from time immemorial, it's been very auspicious at a certain time, it always happens in January, it's freezing cold, to bathe at a certain instant in that confluence, at that point, and you get liberation. So people all over India, they know that. They're raised with that culture, right? So they trek there by the millions. I mean, it's like 20 million people sometimes. It's a huge city. It goes up overnight. And Prabhupada is explaining this on the tape. And he's saying how, yes, they have a government, they have a post office, they have a militia, they have police, everything. They build, roads, temporary roads, so that they can, these people can live for, a week, 2 weeks, whatever. And then at a certain point, they all try to bathe in the river. So Prabhupada calls it, and there's a purpose behind it. They're all there for a purpose, which is to get liberation by bathing at that time. So he calls it a big fair. It's like a fair.
Yeah.
You know, a fair, like we have the Del Mar Fair, right?
Yeah.
So it's temporary. But suddenly there's a whole lot of things manifest and everyone's working to the same effort for a certain purpose. Here it's just to have a good time and sell some things. But there, it's to get liberation, right? And then, after it's over, the whole thing dissolves. Everybody walks back, goes back where they were, the police leave and everything till next time. So this world, this whole world, is a big fair. It is a creation by Krishna, by God, to give us a chance to achieve success in our life. And we get a lot of chances, actually, as in the manifestation. And the human form is really the chance, But there's a huge, creation. Just think of all the things that go on to make this world work and happen. So what's the purpose of it? I used to ask that as an eighth grader, ninth grader. What is that purpose? Remember that? What is the purpose? Life. Right? And we consult the main philosophers from Plato to Socrates on up through the Western. And they had their own ideas, but no one really was satisfying answer to me, But there is a purpose. There is a purpose. The purpose is actually twofold. The first purpose is to allow us to play out our karma. Each of us has a certain amount of activities that we've done in previous life, and they implicate these lives that we're in now. Just like in this life, we know that if you do certain things, then it'll have either a good or bad influence. Now, they say, of course, you should get an education, otherwise you'll have a tough life. Now they're finding that paying for college can be a negative because you come out, you have no job, but you owe them $100,000.
That's the next bubble. I believe that's the next bubble.
But anyway, you got to get an education, a high school education. You got to learn to read, right? And there's so many other things that you need to do. But at the same time, there's some bad things you can do. If you get into drinking, that's bad, And at first, it may not seem so bad. You're just having a good time. But over time, you realize, oh my God, now I'm an alcoholic, I'm wrecking my liver. That's karma. That's instant karma, almost instant. It happens in this lifetime. But why not through several lifetimes? Assuming, as Krishna is teaching here, that we are the soul, which is indestructible, eternal, ever-existing, and a primeval, doesn't die. So we are experiencing right? Different stages of our body, both in this life and in future lives, coming from past life. So if we see it, the karma coming due in this life, by obvious things like drinking or STDs or so many things, actions have their consequences, right? So why not over different lives? It is. That's the law of karma. And there is a lawgiver. There is someone who executes the law. And that's the higher control, beginning with the super soul, but all of the devas and everything. It's a very complicated affair. So this is all an arrangement. And it's an arrangement for Krishna, by Krishna, to allow us to play out our karma, but at the same time, to receive knowledge like this so that we can complete the real purpose of this creation, which is to allow us to escape it. That's the purpose of it. Is to give us a means to get out of the bondage of this world, which is characterized by birth and death. And in between, you can enjoy old age and disease. it's not a pleasant place. It's so far away from our actual nature as eternally blissful and full of knowledge. But we've forgotten that. So Krishna comes to remind us. And even though it's amazing, even though it's inconceivable in our present state of mind because we don't understand, we have to try to understand. And the wonderful thing is, if we act on this knowledge and we practice yoga according to the way Krishna is describing it, then we'll be able to, the existence of the soul will make more and more sense to us. Because we experience what Krishna is giving us. And eventually, we'll be able to see not only the soul, but the super soul. That's the promise. That the vision, the perception, the perceptive ability becomes refined. There's a nice verse. What is it? Atakshi Krishna nama adi nabave grayam indriyai seva mukhe hijivado swayabeva sporatida. That with these present senses, we cannot perceive the real nature of the holy name of Krishna, or his form, or even his existence. But if we begin serving, if we begin the process of yoga, beginning with the tongue, chanting the name, the sacred mantra, Maha Mantra, which is right there, and tasting prasadam, then one day Krishna will reveal himself. Yes. Swayam eva sporatyada. That he himself reveals himself. So it's just like, to understand something that's a total mystery, what do? You go to someone who knows. Even in ordinary education. If you're going to understand, advanced chemistry, for instance, you can try on your own, you can read your own books, but are you really going to understand it thoroughly? No, you have to go to a teacher, someone who's experienced, who knows. And then they can, guide you through the experiments and everything, so one day you'll become skilled. Medical science. You can't do it on your own. You're not going to get certified just studying on your own. You have to go to a recognized source of knowledge. So the same thing is true for this kind of spiritual knowledge, which is so subtle and so confidential. And that's why we need to approach a teacher known as a guru, someone who's realized. This is the great value of Srila Prabhupada's books, is that he's speaking totally from the realized platform. There's no maybe, perhaps in these. He's simply laying it out as it is, as it was revealed, to him and to previous, what we call acharyas, or spiritual teachers. And so, by accepting the knowledge, and by acting on it, then we can eventually get what we call realized knowledge, or vigyan. There's gyan, or theoretical knowledge, and then there's vigyan. I like to compare to, learning to play an instrument. You hear someone playing the violin, or the flute, or the cornet, or something. He said, "Oh, that sounds so beautiful. You're attracted. I want to learn how to do that." So you pick it up. I know so many people, like, because I play the flute. "Oh, can I play?" "So yeah, try it." "Foo, foo, foo." You can't get a sound out of it, right? And then 90% they'll give up at that point, But how do you learn? Okay, then you have to be trained. Yes, you make the embouchure this way, just the angle and so forth, and you play the, and eventually you're making music. That's vigyan. The knowledge is, okay, there's such a thing as flute playing, and there's a method to do it. But the vigyan is that you yourself can play music, and that's what you're looking for. You're looking for direct experience. So we're assured. Now, who backs this up? A whole line of, you know, realized souls. If you disbelieve this and you disregard it, well, you're free to do that. It's a free country, you know. But that means that you're disregarding a whole what we call parambra, the septic succession of realized souls, great towering intellects and saints, you know, who prove by their behavior, you know, that, you know, they're saying, like Srila Prabhupada and his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Gokish. These are all recognized saints, and they show by their erudition, their writings and so forth. So why should we just throw that off? On what basis? Well, it doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah, that's what Krishna says. It's amazing. It is amazing. The existence, what to speak of the existence of the soul, the existence of a person who knows everything. I mean, that to me, that's always the most amazing quality of Krishna. To know everything. How much do we really know? Hardly anything, right? Even the greatest scholar knows practically nothing. You can't even tell how food is being digested in your stomach, how you're growing, what's going on in your, you know, own body. But Krishna, to know everything, so there's someone who knows everything past, present, and future. That's God. That's called omniscience. It's there in Western theology as well. But certainly that's inconceivable. We have no experience of it. But that's the claim. That's the claim of these books. Krishna says, Vedaham Samaditani. So if that's true, then we have to integrate that into our life. We have to deal with that. We don't have to worry if it's true that we're going to die. We know that, you know. Well, we have to deal with that. Then either, we have two choices, you know. Either the soul is eternal, and we're going to live afterward, and that's going to be part of our experience. We have to deal with that. Or life simply is just a combination of matter and grows up in that. And then I'll tell you, there's no reason for morality, you know. There's no reason for ethics. Everyone should just try to grab as much pleasure as they can, which is what they're doing, you know, one block from here, basically. The heck with tomorrow, you know, just get drunk tonight. You know, party. I mean, that's basically part of, you know, what's going on in America. And all over the world, that's America. So, that's the two logical paths. One is, there is a God, there is a soul, there is a system to it, there are laws, and that there is a way of acting where I can achieve ultimate happiness forever. Or that's just a pipe dream. That's just somebody's dream because they couldn't stand real life. And let's just go for it. One of those two. So I'm going with the first one. You know, I'm going with the first. And it's not just theoretical. You know, having lived this life for almost 40 years, I can say, boy, I thank my lucky stars, because I was leading the hedonistic life in the 60s. That's how old I am. And where did it get me? You know, I was depressed, confused, and I would probably be dead by now. You know, if you just follow the arc of all you know, my old friends. But now, 40 years later, you come to a kirtan. You know, even if it's not true, it's a nice lifestyle. What to speak of it is true. The point is that we're not completely bereft of direct experience of these things. That the chanting of the holy name, serving Krishna, living as simply as possible, not trying to, you know, to suck out as much pleasure from the senses as possible, and then having to suffer, you know, the reaction to that. I always give the example of the drugs, because drugs are a perfect paradigm of, you know, immediate gratification and to heck with tomorrow, right? That's the mood of drugs, right? So, you know, I've seen, I mean, I remember this graphically. Forgive me. Whoever brought the water, thanks. I mean, you know better than I do, you know, most of you, because this is, in my day, methamphetamine was just becoming prominent. Now it's all over the place. So, there's a video, there's a YouTube thing. You know, people who got into meth and then 3 years later. You ever see it?
No.
Just destroyed. You know, face destroyed, unhappy, miserable, you know. You know, just 2 or 3 years of that drug is so destructive. And there's no going back. You've done permanent damage, you know, you're finished. Your teeth are rotted out. Right? I mean, I don't have to get graphic about it. But what happened? Well, when they first took it, they weren't thinking of that, right? There was obviously some high there. It goes on for days, you know, you're on top of things and everything's cool, you know. But it's not cool because it's all depending on your physical body. And the physical body has limits. And you're way exceeding them when you're pouring these drugs. And so then, you know, then what? 2 years later, you know, you're 32 instead of 30, and you're wrecked. You know, you got to live in that body. You know, so that's sense gratification to the ultimate degree. Nunam pramatta kurute vikarma yadindriya pitayapanoti. It's certified right in the shastra, in the Purana, the Bhagavad Purana. Certainly, those who are simply, wholly and solely concerned with sense gratification are mad. Now, he says they're mad because they're going to get another material body for suffering. But even this material body, you're going to suffer. Totally, you know. It's not a mystery. It's a medical fact. Eating. Just eat whatever you want, as much as you want. Then what? Then what happens when you get diabetes? You live the rest of your life and, you know, it can be a horror. Diabetes, it's an epidemic. So the point is, but a life of self-control, of yoga, of chanting Hare Krishna, you know, the holy name of Krishna is like, it's a source of unlimited pleasure. And it doesn't depend on the senses. It's just the consciousness contacting the supreme consciousness. It's not limited by the body. You know? You go on, you're chanting for 6 hours, there's no bad side effects. You know, you don't have a hangover. You feel great. Let's do another 6 hours. Prabhupada, this one Prabhupada in the lecture, he says, 16 rounds? Why not 16,000 rounds? When you get to that point, you know that you've made some advancement. In other words, you don't want to stop. With material pleasure, you don't want to stop, but it stops. It does stop. There's a limit, right? There's always a limit. And then there's a reaction. That pleasure, Prabhupada says, right in the purport here, the pleasure you get from the senses is actually the greatest enemy of the enjoyer. Right? Because it completely covers your knowledge. You're thinking only of that. But he says, it's the source of your misery. So where am I going to get my pleasure? We're enjoying beings. You have to get it on a spiritual platform by contacting the reservoir of all pleasure through bhakti yoga. So first, however, we have to understand that we are spirit, not matter. And that we have to act on the spiritual platform. And how to do that, that's described in the rest of this Bhagavad Gita. All right, I'm sorry I went on too long. Any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu.
This might be too long to answer, but I was just thinking the other day, because Ignacio was talking about sleeping and dreaming. How do you define reality? Because we usually say that this is real, it's temporary, but it's still real. But it's always shifting and changing. So similarly, aren't dreams in the same category? You're actually experiencing it, but it's very, very temporary. Even yeah. Is that also
real? You know, what is really real? Now, there's a spectrum of reality. In the Bhagavatam, there's something called the Vastava Vastu. You know, the second verse, right? It says, in this science, in this Bhagavad Purana, you're going to really get to the Vastava Vastu, which means the real thing, the real reality. Vastu means a thing that's actually existing. So we don't have to search very far. Just go back a few verses and you'll find nasato vidite babo na babo vidite sita. For the asat, there is no real existence. And for the sat, there is no non-existence. Now what that means is that what we have here is real. It's a real dream. Meaning that the dream is very real to you when you're having it. It's something. But it's always changing. So it's not what it seems. You have to understand this world for what it really is. What this world really is an ever-changing display of the energies of God. You know, this is what they are. These are material energies. They're not. They're categorically different from you, from the soul. And if you identify with this ever-changing these ever-changing entities, beginning with your ever-changing body, then you'll be out of sync with who you really are. Because we as souls never change. That's one of the qualities of Ikaryaya. We never change. But we're conscious beings. But now our consciousness is absorbed in the ever-changing externals, beginning with our body. And so we're in an unnatural position. Instead of feeling that we're eternal, we want to be eternal. No one wants to die. We have to die because we've identified with the dying body, right? Instead of reaching the point of happiness and bliss and satori or nirvana, you know, it can't be achieved through this material body. So we're frustrated. And we certainly are not. So the idea, what is real and what is unreal? What is real is spirit, because it never changes. But spirit is not just, you know, some vague force. It's variegated. It's as variegated as this world is. But now all we see is the reflection. We're seeing the reflection of the real. Just like you're seeing the moon reflected in a pond. You know? So the ripples are going there. If all you know is the reflection, you say, oh my God, the moon is moving here and there and there. No, it's not. It's up in the sky, steady as anything. So we're looking at the pond. We're looking at this changing phenomena of this world. And we're thinking, oh, this is reality. But we're forgetting that the real reality, which is pure spirit, ever unchanging spirit. So the short answer is, what is real is what is unchanging. And what is unreal is the ever-changing. But even the ever-changing is real in the sense that it's an emanation of the real. But you see what I mean? So that's it. So it's not like it's all false. You know? It's a real dream, and it can have real effects on us if we identify with it. So we have to withdraw from that and go to the reality. Okay, one more. Ben, you're up first.
One quick comment and a question. A teacher of mine, he had a friend who, you had mentioned being put under anesthesia.
Yeah.
And he actually, he was able to identify with the spirit soul to the extent that he had open heart surgery without anesthesia.
Oh my God.
And then my question being, as far as the verse, would it be appropriate to say that Krishna's indirectly calling himself amazing?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, the thing is, he's talking about the soul, but we're part and parcel of this, you know, super soul.
If part and parcel is so amazing, then how amazing?
Yeah, in other words, and I'm really even more amazing, you know. Yeah, we'll get to that, the rest of the Gita. It's inconceivable. It's a guyam, guyatamam, you know, this confidential knowledge. But before we get to these most confidential, we have to get to the confidential, which is the knowledge of the soul. Okay, we better end now because it's time. All glories to Shri Prabhupada.